All right, quieting down now. Live from the Brit and Yankee Pub Studios, it's those two fat guys, Phil and Mark, with another Brit and Yankee craft beer pubcast. I can hear the pints being pulled right now.
Not a while, dude. Bring the drums in. Let's have a party. Pump up the bitter. Shh, test it. Pump up the bitter. Pump up the bitter. Pump up the bitter.
Take it away, lads.
Pump up the bitter.
You are paying for that beer, aren't you?
Hello everybody, this is Pubcast 222 and I'm Phil Clark, landlord of the Brit and Yankee Pub, located here in darkest West Chicago and on the internet. If you want to get a hold of us, our email is pints@thebritandyankee.com and you'll find us on Facebook and Twitter. And we're the only Brit and Yankee out there, so you shouldn't have a problem. You can play our podcast from all smartphone podcast apps, and of course we're on iTunes, so if you want to push out a 5-star rating for us, we'll read that out on the show. The Brit and Yankee Craft Beer Podcast usually focuses on suburban breweries, but in this edition we're going to head down to Chicago's Ravenswood neighborhood and visit with the brewers and owner of Empirical Brewery. Mark is off gallivanting around breweries in Idaho, so I went solo to meet with these folks. Now, this interview came about with the help of a local band, Midwestern Lull, and their band member, Mark Toliusis, who we have had some long-distance relationship across the Facebook waves. We played some of their music in past shows, so they asked us if we'd like to come down to their gig at the brewery, and ahead of their gig, do a podcast interview with the fine folks of Empirical Brewing. And of course, we jumped at that opportunity. So in this interview, CEO Bill Hurley and brewers Julia Davis and Jacob Houston all sit down ahead of that concert and discuss the brewery history and philosophy, among other topics. And of course, we'll sample some of their brews. We'll play a tune from the Midwestern Lull EP Farmhouse Sessions at Midpoint. And if you want to know more about these guys, head out to their website at www.midwesternlull.com or their record label site, which is www.railwayrecords.com, where you can listen to other artists on this label or listen to their Railway Radio streaming service. For now, let's head over for an insight into a brewery that truly focuses on their local roots and is growing in recognition and expanding out to other neighborhoods. It's Empirical Brewery. The Brit and Yankee podcast usually hits suburban breweries, so I'm a little out of my comfort zone here today, and I don't have Mark with me. He's out checking out breweries in Boise, Idaho. Oh. But I do have three wonderful people sitting around me here because I'm at Empirical Brewing down in the... Is this the Ravenswood area?
Yep.
Yeah. It's on Ravenswood and Foster. Sitting with me are the two brewers, Julia Davis.
Hello.
Jacob Houston?
Houston. Yep, like the city. Hey, how's it going?
No O in the last name. And the man himself, the CEO and owner, Bill Hurley. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
It is. Just about morning, right? We're heading into the afternoon.
Oh, no, it just went to afternoon. We're good.
So we're down here because we had played the music from a Chicago band by the name of Midwestern Lull on our show several times. And they're doing a concert here after we've had our chat, which is really good. And I look forward to listening to some of that music. But beforehand, we wanted to understand a little bit about Empirical Brewery, find out how you guys brewed your beers, what your philosophy was, and just get some background on it. So I want to start off by asking Bill, your tagline is exploring the science of beer. And to me, that's got many aspects to it. So tell us where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's part science, part art when you're brewing beer. But when I was coming up with the concept for the brewery, the original concept back in 2011 was to kind of focus on something that most breweries really weren't doing at that time, which is they were incorporating feedback. And most of the feedback was, oh, this beer is great. You should definitely open a brewery. You know, this is fantastic. It was all their friends. What I wanted was I wanted real feedback. I wanted the people to tell us, okay, that tastes like garbage, or go in this direction. Yeah. And I really wanted to involve the community in the whole process. And, you know, that way the brewery gets better. And I think it becomes more of a family atmosphere that you're dealing with. So the science part of it is really just that collection and analysis of the data. And, of course, my background is I was a financial analyst for many years. That's my strength, is looking at data.
So you had the dollars in the background. You knew how much it was going to cost, right?
Well, no, I really didn't. I wasn't even close. But no, the whole idea behind exploring the science is really exploring not just the you know, scientific elements of producing the beer, but it's also that kind of empirical data, collecting that data. And that's actually where the name of the brewery came from, collecting that empirical data, reincorporating it, analyzing it, reincorporating it, and then getting better as a result.
And so your beers are in bottles. There's a certain line of, I guess we'll call them the flagship beers, but you also have a bunch of experimental beers down here, or should I call them development beers, which I guess you're telling me the clientele come in and vote upon or say which they really like. And all the names are scientific in their background.
Right.
What came, you know, how did that come about? Was that intentional because of the science of beer?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the whole theme being the reincorporation of the data, and then it's obvious that we needed a theme. Everyone kind of enjoys science these days. It's become very, you know, it's become part of the popular culture. If you look at shows like Big Bang Theory and Mythbusters, you know, two of my favorite shows, it's fun. Science is actually fun, and people enjoy it. And it gives us the opportunity to kind of come up with some pretty cool names and have fun with the whole process. If we're not having fun, I don't know why we're doing this. So
yeah, and from the consumer's point of view, I would 100% agree, because that's what it's all about. I was talking to you earlier on. Now, the English pub is kind of where you sit down and you chat and you talk about everything and nothing, right? So with that, of course, I want to get a beer inside me, because I've yet to taste one of your beers, and you've laid out a beautiful flight of eight different beers. I'm not going to get through them all, but
I'm torturing you a little bit, but I was nice initially. I gave you the three flagships, all right, starting with our newest one, which is the Cold Fusion Cream Ale. And I'll let the brewers talk to these, but Heliotropic Hoppy Pale Ale is next, and then Infinity IPA. Those are three bottled beers. You'll notice they're all light in color. They range in alcohol from 5.2 to 6.7, so pretty mainstream. They're not mainstream beers, though. They kind of pick a style and go to the edge of it. Next is the Kolsch, which is a pure experimental beer, just something that we're serving in the taproom. That's why it doesn't have a name. And then starting with the second flight, this is where it gets, I get a little angry.
Angry?
I'm torturing you, I should say. So El Dorado Smash, I put that in there because we do a lot of smash beers. It's single malt and single hop. And
one of my favorite styles, actually.
Yeah, it's actually one of our most popular things to do here in the tap room, and the brewers can talk about that. And then this is where it gets crazy. The three higher alcohol beers on the list right now, two of them are seasonal beers for us. They're keg only, but they're sold seasonally 3 months out of the year. Phase Transition Robust Porter with PNCO brown sugar in it, Double Helix Imperial IPA, and then the Doppelbach, which is a taproom only. That's, again, why it doesn't have a proper name right now.
So you've actually covered some newer styles and some classic styles here. So I'm going to give the Cold Fusion Cream Ale a quick slurp, and I'm going to ask Jacob, tell us a little bit about this beer. And are you the one brewing this one, or is this Julian?
That's both of us. Julian and I share all the work here at the brewery, from procuring the ingredients to drinking it at the end. the cream ale, we wanted something light and also something that's not necessarily always around the market. Cream ales, there's really a hole here in Chicago for them, so we wanted to fill that gap. We wanted something, it's light, it's easy to drink, but it's also got a ton of flavor in there. And we switched up, but it's not necessarily fully traditional because we added a bunch of rye to it. But it's a fun, drinkable beer.
I've tasted that, and the cream ales are one of my favorite styles. I don't know why. They kind of go from a pilsner up to a pale ale, maybe somewhere in there. When I first came over to this country, I was very familiar with the cream ale, the Genesee, I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a classic, I guess. Tasting this one, it does have quite a bite to it, but it's as you say, it's a very light bite. So very drinkable beer. Or as we will call it, pintable. So we like this one. This one is pretty good. So if you're putting that one into the brewery here and into bottles, that's a good choice to start with. Julia, it's not often, and in fact, I think you are the first female brewer that we've got to talk to on the show. How did you get into this business?
Well, I spent 5 years doing office work and litigation support, and it was one of those jobs that pays the bills, but it's not terribly exciting or anything. And at the same time I got into home brewing, I lost my last job in litigation support. I was like, do I really want to keep doing office work, or do I want to try and do something that I love? And so in 2010, I went to brewing school, the Siebel Institute, and I've been in the brewing industry ever since. And to kind of dovetail with what Bill was saying earlier, one of the things that I really love about brewing is that it's a perfect confluence of so many things. It's art, it's science, it's history, it's physical labor, it's mental labor, and being able to roll all those into what I do for a living is something that I absolutely love.
And one thing we found that when we've been doing these interviews is that everybody has a passion, which is absolutely the key item behind running a brewery successfully, I think. The fact that you're passionate and won't have that quality level drop down. Now, as I sit here, I notice you have some good ink on your arm. But that brought me, actually, I'm segueing into your logo. Okay, now your logo is kind of interesting because when I read what you described on the website, it said it was an ideogram of a cunciform or something.
Uniform, yeah.
But then I went on to read that you went to the British, or you saw this in the British Museum, on the bottom of some sort of tablet. Tell us a little bit about that, because it's very interesting.
So it's actually based on the cuneiform language, the first written language known to man. And there's a particular tablet that is pretty common on the internet as well, if you look for it. And that tablet, it's very small. Four times on that tablet, the word beer was written. And you kind of wonder why. Well, it was because beer was very important to humanity at the time. And it was just as important as bread. It basically is the same thing as bread. And in fact, when you look at the history of beer, there's actually a program I think the History Channel did where it was how beer saved the world. You know, and they talk about...
I saw that.
Yeah, it's good.
That was good.
And they talk about how, you know, they found tetracycline, a powerful antibiotic, in the bodies of mummies. They said, well, how did they have a powerful antibiotic? And it turns out if you brew beer according to the Egyptian recipe, that was a byproduct of the process. And so when they would drink these at the time it was very low alcohol product, obviously, they would feel better. There was antioxidants in it, there was proteins in it, all kinds of good stuff, antibiotic. So you think about that and you think about the history of it, and it's fun. It's really cool. But also, you know, when I was coming up with the idea for the brewery, it just goes back to I wanted to pay homage to the past of this product. You know, I really do love beer. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that I incorporated a historic context into kind of the logo. So that was pretty obvious, the very first written word. I was shocked no one had done it before. It's possible that someone has done a logo off of it, but we basically took...
We haven't been sued yet, right?
I'm sure it'll come. But no, we took the original form, which was kind of the shape of the vessel that would go into the ground. It was a cone-shaped vessel that would be partially buried in the ground in the deserts to make sure it stayed cool enough for fermentation. And we modernized it, you know, sharpened it up a little bit, and then turned it into a lowercase e. So that's been our logo ever since. It's on our original tap handle, and in fact, it, because of the shape, it's a perfect bottle opener, which is a little known fact about our original tap handle. So.
Is that little kind of break from the V at the bottom that goes in? So, okay, cool. How useful. So you do actually, talking of bottles, you do put three of your beers into bottles, correct?
Right now. Yes. Yep. And we have some seasonals that we also put into bottles right now as well.
But is that into bombers or 12 ounces or what?
Just
what's your preference?
12-ounce bottles is what we're currently doing right now.
And going forward, now that we moved to the flagships into distribution, the seasonals will only be offered in the taproom and in the brew pub to go, in bottles, that is. They'll still be out in the world in kegs.
Something that you, from a historical note that's close to my heart, is that you do firkins here. I see on your chalkboard you have a Friday firkin, which is nice to see. Tell us a little bit about the firkin program. Who's on that? Julian?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about it.
Go on, then.
So, yeah, basically, as part of our experimental thing, and, of course, to do just something fun for the tap room every Friday, we always have some firkins going. So we tap a new firkin every Friday, and we'll take usually one of our flagship beers or sometimes one of our seasonal beers and do some special ingredients in there. And we'll do something different every Friday, unless there's a recipe that we really like, in which case we'll try repeating it. Again, this kind of goes back to the whole empirical method thing. It's like, okay, we have this idea that we really want to do. We didn't get 100% this time, but we can do this, and we'll really nail it this time. So we've had a couple firkins that we've come back to that have just been even better than ever.
So I'm actually going on to the next beer. I'm drinking the Heliotropic Hoppy Pale Ale. And, yeah, I would go with that. I think it's more hoppy than the pale bit, but that's my taste. In fact, actually, I was just trying, I think we just reviewed the latest offering from Two Brothers, which was the Pinball, which was they called it a hoppy pale as well. Between the two, you've got more oomph in yours. I'm telling you that right now. I kind of like this. Where does the line get drawn between going to an IPA and people thinking it's a pale ale? Because I think when you oomph up the hops, you know, and you don't have the malt in the backbone there, which I think is more traditional in the UK to have more malt in there, you know, how does that work out for you? I've stumped him.
No, I totally went off track there in my mind.
Well, the IPA style is completely separate.
Right. Yeah. It really comes down to style guidelines, especially for when you're sending out for judgments, like the BJCP style guidelines. It really, at this point, will come down to the alcohol content and the IBUs, or the international bittering units. Mm-hmm. I think once you exceed a certain amount of the bitterness units, you're probably moving more into the IPA category.
Right. Okay. Well, we like our IPAs and we like our pale ales, but I think pale ales are more of my preference when you come down to the beer. One beer that so drinking this Heliotropic, it is nicely hopped up. What are the stats on this one?
It's 5.5%. It's around 35 IBUs. So it's a little high on the IBU end for...
I thought it was going to be higher.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
The flavor's there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The flavor's definitely there. Yeah. But we do use copious amounts of hops in this beer, especially we do really heavy dry hopping with it. And we use Comet hops, especially in this beer, which is kind of a forgotten about hop. It's been around for a long time. Not many people use it very often. We're big fans of it. It gives a lot of really fun characteristics. Because we like a lot of tropical juiciness from hops, we also really like some piney earthiness from it as well. I like a nice balance between the two.
That's the first time I've actually heard of that hop, so it must be fairly old. I mean, you know,
when they started using it, I thought it was brand new because they are coming up with new hops all the time.
It's spelled with a C, not a K, right?
Right. Here we come. And all of a sudden, I realized, you know, I read up on it. I was like, no, it's a very old hop. It's just out of favor, which is bizarre, but you know that happens.
Buffalo soldier, dreadlock rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival.
Let me change the topic a little bit.
Cats.
So, not the musical, but the fact that I think you're quite you like the adopted dogs, and you've got adopted cats. Yes. Tell us about that program that's going on. I was fortunate enough to go out in the brewery and saw the Home From Home there, which is quite nice, actually. It's quite nicer than my house, man.
Well, when we first opened, you know, this is Chicago, and it does have a rat problem, a lot like many other large cities. We first opened, we did the traditional, you know, poisons and traps and everything else. And when those were successful, we had dead rats in the building, which is pretty gross. And when it was not successful, we had to throw our grain out.
Yeah.
So we got to the point where, you know, when, if you think about what we're doing in here, we got an old drafty manufacturing center that is impossible to kind of button up. And even if you could, rats can actually chew through concrete and metal, which they did in one case. Wow. They chewed their way under one of our doors. So when you think about it, it's an impossible battle because we've got, when you put grain out, and especially when you brew that grain, it's like ringing the dinner bell for these guys. And they were coming from miles around, I feel like. So it got to the point where we would have to order grain, use it that day, and just be done with it. So my wife works for Channel 11 WTTW, the PBS station here in town.
Okay.
And you know, she had told me about this program they had started for adopted cats. There were feral cats that were found around town, and they were in danger of being killed. They were in a bad situation. They would take these cats, trap them, and put them into a facility to protect that facility. So they would acclimate them to the facility. The cats would understand this is their new home. Sometimes they went outside, sometimes they didn't. But the whole idea is that the owner of the facility would feed them, keep them, you know, in good health. And as payment, they would receive protection from any rats or mice that are in the facility. So I didn't think it was going to work because, you know, taking on these cats was a responsibility that, frankly, I didn't want to take. But when they explained the program to us, you know, the cats would not interfere at all. They would stay away from everything. They, frankly, probably wouldn't even be seen most times. And you just have to feed them, and it's 100% effective. You know, I was on board. So we talked about it. There's no health consequences to the beer. It's all brewed in a closed system anyway. So once I kind of understood the program, we took them on. That day that they came in, they're acclimated in these large dog-sized crates that are all kind of bundled together. Okay. They have to stay in there about 30 days. That's their home while they understand this is their new, you know, home base. So we bring them in, never saw a rat again after that. There's not been one rodent in this facility since then. And we don't see dead ones, we don't see droppings, we don't see anything. And in exchange, you know, again, all we have to do is feed them, and frankly, they become part of the empirical family. They come out, Ray even lets us pet them. So
I have a question in listening to that. You said that beforehand you had traps and you'd see the dead rats. So what happens to the rats now? Do the cats eat them?
No, they just don't come in. We've never seen one come in.
I don't even see them in the alley anymore.
The rats are smart then.
Right. Yeah, they say they have a quarter mile radius, effective radius, when they put them in a facility, and a mile radius if they're allowed outside.
Wow.
And that's been our experience.
That's pretty good. Well, obviously, going back there, I saw you've got the grain all around. I would imagine that you'd be able to see that evidence because they'd be right. chewing on the corner there. Speaking of your grain, where do you get your grain and malt from? What's your favorite?
We get our malt from a variety of different suppliers. Vireman, RAR, some from Simpsons and Thomas Foss into the UK.
Okay.
If I personally
good man.
If I had personally had to pick a favorite malt, I would say Golden Naked Oats. It's a crystal malt that's produced with oats instead of barley, and it has this incredible nutty, fruity sort of characteristic. It gives a lot of body to a beer as well. And we use that in the phase transition, I believe.
Did you use it in the Kolsch? Because no, I'm drinking the Kolsch right now, and I'm getting a nice nutty background to it. Nutty bready is what I'm getting on this one. I like this a lot. Kolsch is a style that Mark introduced me to, and it was just one of my, it's a great summer drinking beer, I think.
Yeah. We might bottle that.
All right. Got to think of a name now. Got to think of a scientific name, right?
If I may talk about the Kolsch, is an extremely simple recipe, and we kind of do the same fermentation process with the Kolsch as we do with the cream ale, because those are both hybrid beers kind of produced at temperatures between traditional ale and lager temperatures, which is part of what gives them their cleanliness and their unique yeast characteristic. Okay. So the Kolsch is very simple malt base, mostly just base malt with a little bit of flaked maize. That hybrid fermentation process, and it's one of my favorite beers here. I mean, this is really Jacob's baby, but it is really just super clean, super easy drinking, super bright.
It's clear as a bell too.
It's absolutely great.
This is not
filtered either. And it's not filtered. My goodness. Oh, yeah, it is clear as a bell. We'll take some pictures. Now, you said you put flaked maize in. Does that have the same effect as putting oatmeal into a stout to make it a little smoother?
Because
I found this very smooth.
Yeah, somewhat. It gives some smoothing characteristics. It gives a little more mouthfeel and sometimes aids in head retention, which is very similar to using, like, flaked oats, such as you would in, like, stouts.
Right. Mm-hmm. I skipped over the Infinity IPA because we did actually review that out of a bottle way back, a few shows back, and we enjoyed it. Thought it was pretty good. Okay. I wanted to head a little bit further down here to some of your experimentals now. And as I was saying, the Eldorado and a Smash is one of my favorites because I think it's very simple. So why do Smashes? Why do you guys do Smashes?
The main reason we do smashes is to really get the true flavors, mainly from the hops. We're mainly using smash beers for the hops, not necessarily the malt profile. There's so many new hop varieties out there right now, and a lot of them are becoming more scarce. So we're just really experimenting with everything out there, trying to find our favorite hops and what we want to use in things. So we procured a decent amount of varieties and going to make some smash beers with them and see which ones are our favorite, and also see which ones the customers, what are their favorites as well.
Well, let me give you my impression of this one. I'm getting kind of a almost lemony, but it's some type of citrus. I wouldn't think it's grapefruit. And I get a lot of it up front, and then afterwards it just finishes very clean. It's slightly cloudy, unless this is condensation on the outside. I better rub it. No, it's slightly cloudy. Again, a very easy drinking beer. I can see where a lot of people might not go for that, and they might go for the Kolsch or the cream, but from my perspective, I always like smashes because they tend to be a little more raucous, a little more down to earth, and this one I think is pretty good.
And if I may, I think the whole smash method is kind of part of the empirical process. Really, it's about narrowing down the variables to what one thing do we want to focus on and experiment with. And with a smash beer, it usually comes down to do we want to experiment with this particular malt or this particular hop. And smash beers are excellent for narrowing down what characteristics we want out of a hop and seeing, you know, what we get out of each different hop. It's like, okay, we like this because it has this characteristic, but we don't like this because it has this characteristic. And so being able to do smash beers is a good way of being able to figure out which ingredients we want to stick with and which are like, we can pass this by in the future.
Okay.
So it's part of the whole scientific process for us.
Guys are very theme oriented, so the names of your beers are scientific. Who's a Star Wars fan?
Oh, that would be all of us.
Definitely all of us.
Because just to explain, your development tanks are all named after Star Wars characters
planets.
And planets.
Yep, planets.
Planets, is it? Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all Tatooine, is it?
Tatooine is one of the five fermenters that we have on the pilot system. Yeah, I mean, we're big nerds here. It comes with, you know, the science and the beer, everything. We have a lot of movies and a lot of music quotes and names you'll see a lot around here, especially with the Firkins. We name them usually after a movie reference or some kind of song reference.
So that brings me to the good question I like to ask everybody. Who's your favorite music that you play? I mean, every brewer seems to play some different type of music whilst they're doing the brewing. Jacob?
Yeah, we kind of do listen to...
Eclectic, Bill, eclectic.
We listen to a lot of different stuff. Well, when we're brewing, there's a lot of loud noises going on. So essentially, I just want something in the background that I can hear and that is upbeat and keeps me going. So yeah, some heavy metal or some dancey kind of stuff is nice, but I'm also really into reggae.
All right.
A lot of Britney Spears.
No.
Britney
Spears? No.
Come on now.
Julia?
I am a musician.
You have to listen to what he has to listen to, right? Okay, no.
I am an omnivore when it comes to music. There's not a style of music I don't enjoy. But like Jacob, when I'm in the brewery and I'm listening to music, I want something upbeat that's going to keep us moving.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rock. There's a lot of metal. There's some hip-hop, mostly old school variety. There's also a lot of weird electronic music, but that's my personal preference. I've been a hobbyist musician myself for a long time, so electronic music is kind of where I fall in that category. Okay. So I have a big soft spot for it.
And Bill, you're the opera man, right?
No, I'm Nirvana and 90s hip-hop.
Oh, okay. Is that the era that you grew up? Is that the era you grew up in?
No, I just like what it. I like right now.
Okay,
I'll probably change tomorrow.
Eldorado Smash, very, very tasty little brew. I want to get into something a little heavier here. I know that you had up there, and it was one that was a black IPA with raspberry. Do we have that one here or
Downport?
We don't have that one. Darn! Oh, okay, we can get it later. Well, let's try your robust.
That one, though, so.
Oh, okay. Is it the raspberry that you didn't like?
No, I think what let Jacob explain the particulars of it. But
and why we don't like it?
Yeah.
It's good.
Well, we have really high standards.
Not what we were going for.
Right, we have really high standards for our beer here, and sometimes machinery faults. And that happened during the process of making this beer, and it did end up affecting some of the flavor. Now, it just accentuated the bitterness from the black IPA style.
Which I still like.
Right.
That's why it's on. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd dump it. What I like about it is that it tastes like the skin of the raspberry, is the bitterness kind of component of it.
Okay.
That was not intentional. So that's why we don't want to necessarily serve it to you, because it wasn't what we were going for. Now, we'll definitely drink it.
But isn't that the fun of almost knocked over my robust porter here. Isn't that the fun of brewing something experimentally? You aim for one thing and then you come out with another that could possibly be better or different, just as good.
As long as you can replicate it.
Yes.
Well, I'm assuming that you keep good notes, because a scientist always keeps good notes,
right? I guess
we
could shut down the entire system. We could deliberately kind of shut down the system, but it would be difficult. It would be awkward and weird to try to brew that beer again. And frankly, I think the original concept was better anyway.
Okay. Yeah. If anything, next time we brewed it, it would be better.
Yeah.
Well, the Black IPA is definitely one of my favorites. And, I mean, it really wasn't a style a few years ago, right? But it's become a style, I think. And it's one that I enjoy because it gives me the nice malty flavors I'm looking for and the roasty, toasty flavors I'm looking for, but also gives me a little bit of a bite from the hops. Now, I'm trying your phase transition. So I've transitioned over here from the lighter beers to this really nice dark beer. This is a very aromatic porter. I'm getting I know I'm going to get something here as soon as I put it up to my nose. And in tasting it, I'm getting great flavors of everything that I want in a porter. But again, it's lighter, slightly lighter. Scott, and you've poured out the samples, and this one's retaining its head quite well here and doing some nice lacing on the side of the sample glass. So that's a good sign, too. This is a beer that I could drink all year round. A lot of people say they don't want to drink porters but in the summer. But, hey.
We're talking about doing it all year round.
I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. At least for the brew pub and the tap room, yeah.
And for barrel aging. Look forward to that barrel aging program.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay, two topics there. Number one, you just said, okay, when I said drink it all year round, Bill pointed at me as if to say, yeah, okay, that's great. That's something we could do.
And then barrel aged for all year.
Porter is the same.
Absolutely.
But do you find that styles, you know, the lighter styles get drunk more in the summer and the hot? It's that way, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Anything you can do to change that?
Serve it all year. Exactly.
Convert people.
Barrel aging. So what's your barrel aging program going on? You must have one. Everybody's got one, right?
We do. The current barrels that we had are emptied, and we use them for fun decorations in the tap room. And we're in the middle of bringing in a second round of barrels. We're going to do a little more experimenting this time around and not just do bourbon instead of whiskey kind of barrels. Yeah. Can't wait to do rum barrels for this porter. We're going to get some gin barrels for some of our lighter beers.
Gin's very popular.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. We might really try and experiment with some other stuff, too.
Gin cream ale is really exciting to us.
Yeah. That sounds great, because I've had saisons in gin barrels.
Yeah.
Can't remember what else I've had in a gin barrel, but saison seems to be the one that people pick. But a cream ale? Wow, that's going to be great. Mm-hmm. Have you been in FOBAB? Are you going to go into FOBAB?
We have. We did our barley wine and that we aged in barrels, and we also did our phase transition porter, also aged in bourbon barrels. Yeah.
Cool. I think bourbon barrels and whiskey barrels seem to be the heavy hitters right now, but
right.
I am so bourboned out.
We're the same way, so we're going to switch it up this time around and do a lot of different stuff. I'm even contemplating like tequila barrels for some stuff to really be eclectic. Maybe we can get an aquavit barrel, which is what Julia really wants to do. If we can do some fun experimental stuff.
Aquavit barrel. So aquavit is basically the liqueur in Scandinavia. It's kind of a cumin and caraway spirit. I spent a year living and working in Denmark. Actually, my first brewing job was at a brewery there. Yeah, I mean, I came to absolutely love aquavit, and I have almost never seen aquavit barrel-aged beer in this country, so that is something I've always been really, really interested in doing. So there are some distilleries in this country, including several in Illinois. North Shore Distillery actually makes my favorite aquavit in the country, and I would love to acquire one of their barrels to put...
Send us a barrel.
Yeah, well, what's the number to call? That's very interesting, because I wish I had Mark in now, because being a Scandinavian, he would have been talking about that all day. Unfortunately, he's not, so I'll just have to go with what you're telling me. And that sounds really good. I really like the idea that you're reaching out and trying something different, because you're absolutely right. I've never heard of that going on. Let me go down to one that I wanted to try here, and that's your Double Helix Imperial.
Did you taste the brown sugar in that?
Hang on, I've got to go back and taste the brown sugar.
That was the big component, that the PNCO brown sugar, which is a Mexican brown sugar. They sell it in cones, obviously, or oddly. It's somewhat unrefined. It's less refined than American brown sugar. And so you don't want to refine sugar going into your beer. It just will fall out of solution. It won't get eaten up by the yeast. But also it just imparts a really good flavor to it. It kind of has that rum raisin finish at the end.
You know, I was wondering what it was, because it was kind of something at the end that was kind of earthy there. I don't think, when you say brown sugar, I'm looking for sweetness, but I don't think I get that in this. And I think you succeeded there, but obviously it's given it a different... ending, and I'm going to have to go back. I'll keep this one to my side and try that again, because I know there's one brew out there, Faro, but I think it's a Belgian brew, Lindemann's maybe, and they do it with
Fantastic.
Brown sugar, and I've had that, and that does have a sweet component to it, but it's still a good one. So I, you know, maybe I was looking for that and I didn't get it, so that's great. And
la música ideas portará y siempre continuará. Sonido electrónico, decibel sintético.
I read that you have in the tap room a way of serving your beer where you want to serve it at the right temperature and for the style of beer that it is, right? Am I right on that?
We want to. We haven't implemented
we want
that
to.
Yet.
Oh, okay.
It's nearly impossible to do that right now. But, the original idea was to kind of serve beer at the particular temperature for the style. And there are four different zones of temperature that you kind of want to focus on. We have, due to equipment kind of concerns and issues, we haven't implemented that yet. Nearly impossible to implement in this setting. But it's something that down the road I definitely want to get back to, because there really is a difference. You know, when you, and I can tell you that we recently kind of hosted a national judging competition, okay. homebrew competition. And I asked them up front, I said, do you want me to separate out certain beers, make sure they're served at certain temperatures? And they said, no, don't worry about it. At the end of the day, the judges will be able to kind of, you know, tell, okay, this beer should be set aside a little longer, let that warm up a little bit. They're not that precise with it. But the reality is in a perfect world, we would serve your beer, you know, at a particular temperature for that style. And certainly down the road as we mature, I want to get back to that concept, because that is important. Yeah. And even the glassware matters for that particular style of beer. We have four different pieces of glassware we use in the tap room. It is not by style right now. It's something that, again, we want to get to, but it's very hard to implement something like that.
Well, obviously the reason I brought that up was because everybody, because I'm originally from England, as you can tell, they talk about warm beer, right?
Yeah.
So, and I have to repeatedly tell people, it's not warm beer, it's just beer that's served at cellar temperatures, yeah. And cellars are usually, you know, my basement's usually 52 to 55 degrees, so that's what we serve our beer at, and the flavors start to come out. Definitely, if you've got the more lagery, pilsnery type beers, a little cooler, a little colder. I mean, they're great cool. beers. If you can get a great beer with flavor in a summer day.
They describe that zone, that's the lowest temperature zone for serving beers, and they describe that zone as any beer that you don't want to taste, which I completely disagree
well,
with.
Well, no.
You know, I want to taste the Vienna
that?
Lager. You know, yes. Actually, we have one on tap right now. It's fantastic. You know, I want to taste that beer.
Oh, and that's the one I was going to ask what you guys will. You've got pints of beer here. So, Julie, you're drinking the Vienna Lager.
Yes.
Which is a lovely copper to bright brown, I think. Something like that.
I would call this copper, and that's pretty much exactly the color I was going for on this.
Beautiful color to it. There's a couple of Vienna lagers out there. I know that, was it Devil Back is one of the ones that's a standard out of Virginia, I think. It's just been bought up by one of the big boys. So, what made you brew a Vienna lager then?
Vienna lager is a style that you very, very rarely see anymore. As a matter of fact, the main one you'll ever see on the market is Negro Modelo out of Mexico. And it's interesting because, in fact...
I did not know that was a Vienna lager.
Yeah. And I drink that when I'm on vacation.
Holy cow.
And as a matter of fact, Mexico is kind of the biggest holdout of Vienna lager, because there is a lot of German beer history, specifically out of Mexico. So that style is kind of a holdover that has really retained traction in that country. But a lot of American brewers are kind of coming around more to doing Vienna lagers again. And for me, I love it because it's a style you don't see very often.
Right.
It's very malt focused while being very drinkable and having a good color to it. So it's something I've wanted to work with a lot more. And working on this system, so we have the 30-barrel production system for all the beers that go out to market and that are in the tap room and such. But all of the small-batch experimental beers are out of a small one-barrel system that we work with. And that one-barrel system is what Jacob and I kind of get to play with when we're doing smashes, when we're doing one-off beers like this, when we're testing beers, to see the differences between, you know, this aspect divided across four different beers. And it is actually a very reliable and easy system to work with most of the time. And so we can definitely do lagers on it without any real problems. And I've been wanting to do a Vienna lager for a long time, so is Jacob. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this one turned out very nicely, so I'm very happy to have it on tap finally.
All right, I'm going to have to taste that one. Bill, what are you drinking?
Heliotropic Hoppy Pale Ale.
Okay. Jacob?
Yeah, he ordered that, so I ordered the same thing to make it easy.
Very good.
Well, I always got to be the odd one out, huh? I got to make things difficult.
I think I've headed up to the higher alcohol, but I let you tell me. I'm on the Imperial IPA, so I'm thinking it's 7 or 8%, maybe more.
10.
It is
10?
9.8%.
9.8. Oh, it's not quite 10 then. Okay.
Close to make it easy.
It rounds up.
It rounds up.
I had a feeling it was up there somewhere. It's got a beautiful finish to it. It's kind of that nice... I mean, it's just a good IPA, an Imperial IPA, I have to say. I will have to say that you'd have to be very careful with these.
It's very dangerous. It really drinks like a 6.5%, 7% beer, but it's not.
Yeah. Well, the only reason I said, 8 or 9 was because, that's usually where they are, but this is Royal Disguise. It's not that boozy, so that's great. You guys are doing very well here in the Foster and Ravenswood location, but you're opening up a second one, right?
Yes, we are. I mean, Empirical, again, the idea behind this company was to kind of, bring the community in. So by definition, you can't get too big. Also, I think the whole macro craft movement is overdone. I think it's a bad idea for the industry to kind of move in that direction. And you will notice that a lot of the larger craft breweries that have sold out have sold to foreign interest, which I do not like. That's not the point of this company.
Apart from the British, okay.
Right. So, again, when I formed this company, it was for particular reasons, and one of them was to not get too big. So this company was designed, we do have a 30-barrel system, but this building will actually limit our production in this facility to less than 25,000 barrels, probably less, just because there's no room. We've only got 8,000 square feet back there to work with. But it's a 30-barrel because I want them to spend half the amount of time that they would have to on a 15 and spend more time on that one barrel playing around. So for the company to grow and expand its brand, we're going to open new facilities and kind of keep any particular facility. It kind of goes back to my career. Part of my career was covering semiconductor companies, which is bizarre, right? But I covered Intel for many years. I covered some of the solar manufacturers. And one of the big things with those companies was that they would have a model factory that they would make perfect. And they would roll out all the changes and improvements that they made to that factory to all the other factories. And the idea behind Empirical is you can have that Empirical method, you can adopt to the local culture, and you can still have that culture intact, that concept intact. So Empirical Brew Pub is going to be up in Rogers Park. It's a very different neighborhood than the one we're in, even though it's only 2 miles north. And it will have a 5-barrel electric system this time. There's no particular difference to that, except that it's easier to put into that facility. It'll allow them to, the brewers, to kind of go up there. And in fact, Julia lives in the neighborhood, so her commute will be shorter.
You're going to be brewing up there then.
Yep. I mean, well, I think Jake and I are going to be switching around pretty regularly. But for me, it's going to be the best commute I've ever had, because it's literally a 3-block walk from my apartment.
Staggering distance, as we say.
Exactly.
But the idea is, again, it will still keep that Empirical method, but we're adopting ourselves to that building, that neighborhood. And one thing that's unique is that, here we can have dogs in the taproom because we don't serve food. We have a lot of babies coming to the taproom. We have board games in the taproom. We have all kinds of stuff going on. This is going to be more of a restaurant environment, as it's going to be a brew pub. So probably not a lot of board games, not a lot of people sitting around. We'll probably have a few board games, of course, because there's going to be people that want to sit around and kind of hang out. But, we can't allow dogs in, and we lose that component of our culture by going up there. But what we're adding is licensing will allow us to now serve beer cocktails. That's something that we've wanted to do here that we cannot legally do. And we'll do more collaborations with other breweries, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, it allows us to do things we just can't do here and still maintain that Empirical culture.
I was there when I was red.
One thing I heard you talk about there was beer cocktails.
Yes.
Tell me what your definition of beer cocktails is and how you wanted to do it.
Well, it's not everyone likes beer, unfortunately. It's hard for me to understand, but a lot of people... Exactly. But, I mean, I'm also a fan of liquor and ciders and wines and meads. So able to incorporate our beer with other ingredients into some cocktails is going to be a lot of fun. As far as, like, I go, I want to make awesome, awesome beer and then have our fun staff, because we're hiring some really awesome people to run our new tap room and the brew pub. So they're going to have a lot of fun playing with all these ingredients that we're going to give them, even though I want to be a part of that process with them as well.
So give me a sample. Give me a sample recipe. Because I'm thinking beer cocktail. What are you going to do? You're going to add ESB to vodka or something, or what?
The first one we ever came up with was the Gamma Ray Ginger Mule. Gamma Ray is a ginger wheat beer that we brew once a year. It's only served in this facility. It's a standard wheat recipe with a lot of fresh ginger, lime zest, black peppercorn. In some ways, I think our most popular beer. I mean, people ask for it all year round. They just look forward to that release. We came up with essentially a recipe that was kind of like a Moscow Mule. It was a simple syrup that we made in-house, a little fresh lime juice, I think vodka, and ice.
And topped it off with the beer.
And then topped it off with the beer, obviously. And we had people coming in. I remember one particular couple came in. The wife did not drink beer. And we said, just try this. And we had her try it, and she loved it. She drank that all day. And then we found out, well, we can't really serve this, because the state isn't allowing us to, so we had to pull it off the menu until the laws actually allow us to do, you know, business in the state of Illinois. But no, it's one of those things where the brew pubs have a little bit more, they have a greater ability to do things in the facility, whereas breweries have greater ability to distribute. So for now, you know, we're going to have the best of both worlds. Again, it goes back to you work within the laws that you're given, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
It sounds intriguing, although I'm a bit of a purist myself, so it took me a long time to accept fruit in beer. But
I'm the same exact way.
It's exceptionally good, though. I was really happy with that. And we actually came up with one more recipe we never put on the menu, but it was a bourbon recipe with a smoked tea and our Chromatic Imperial Red Ale. And it was absolutely stunning. And it just sounded terrible when they were explaining it to me, but I tasted it. I would drink this all day. I have to agree.
Yeah. So
you got to try it, you know.
Well, I'd like to try anything, you know. brewing sodas, because you said for not everybody drinks. So are you going to do any craft sodas for non-drinkers? Or is it the fact that, like earlier, you were telling me most people actually walk here because you're in such a neighborhood brewery?
Right.
Any craft sodas? Because my wife doesn't drink, but she loves craft sodas.
Looking at the brewers to see if they want to do a craft soda. I don't think so right now.
I didn't even think about that. I mean,
if there's demand for it,
right. Actually kind of sounds fun.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't planned for it, but it's something we can play around with for sure. Yeah.
I'd like to do meads myself at some point. At least one mead.
But now you're talking. Mead,
that's my request. Oh, yeah. I don't tell them what to do.
Do you want to drink a mead right now? It is a bottle.
Well, maybe afterwards. It is an official BJCP style.
Yes, it is.
So we're okay there. We're allowed to do that. We actually did a show on mead in which we got a bottle from one of the brewers up at Bell's Brewery. He does it on the side. And we compared that to a commercial brand, and we preferred his because it was more meady, if you will. I mean, I got my idea of what mead is, but, you know, that's not to say that's right.
Did you decide if it's beer or wine?
Beer or wine, it's neither. It's honey, baby.
All I know is
it's honey.
It's the first alcohol. That's all I know.
All right, guys. You know, thank you so much indeed. We really appreciate you spending the time with us. We sat here for about 45, 50 minutes. I know that the band is waiting to come on. And, they're in the background listening in. Julia, thank you so much indeed for your time. Jacob, thank you.
Thank you.
I know that you brew 7 days a week. Well, 5 days a week, right? Didn't you hear about the increase? You didn't get the memo, right? Bill, thank you so much indeed for your time. I appreciate it. I think, you know, as I say, we don't get down into Chicago much. We try to focus on the suburbs. The ones we have come to, really good, and I like the neighborhood approach here. This is just superb. And sitting in the background over there, off mic, is Steve, who's a tap room manager, and gonna thank him a lot.
Very shortly.
And Brewpub manager. Okay, great. He's gonna be expanding his responsibilities then. Thanks, Steve, a lot. At the end of whilst you guys were chatting there at the end, I was trying your Doppelbock, and Doppelbock is not one of my favorite styles. I'm just not in that zone. But this one is smooth. It's tasty. I would enjoy this. I think everybody should come down and sample it. It's good. Quickly. It's almost gone, right? Yeah. I think this is another one you do well to put out frequently. This is pretty good. I can't comment on its technical styles. I know Mark would be able to talk about the Kolsch and the Doppelbock all day long. So I'm going to bring him back down here. But in the meantime, of course, we end up our pubcasts by thanking everybody and raising our glasses and saying cheers.
Cheers.
There we go.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
You got any tetleys?
A pint, please, barman. Give another pint, please, barman.